Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Josh Fox, environmental activist and director, best known for his Oscar-nominated 2010 documentary film Gasland, who talks about the refugee humanitarian crisis he recently observed at the U.S.-Mexico border. Egan Kemp, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizen, who discusses his group's recent report, which found that lobbying against proposed Medicare for All universal healthcare legislation has spiked in 2019. And Panayoti Cholkis, of the Prison Ecology Project, who recounts how a broad coalition of environmental and criminal justice reform groups defeated a plan to build a federal prison on a former mountaintop removal coal mine site in eastern Kentucky. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On July 21st, the anniversary of Britain's handover of Hong Kong to China, an estimated 500,000 people participated in peaceful protests while young pro-democracy activists broke into Hong Kong's Legislative Council, the symbol of Beijing's power in the city. After its takeover of Hong Kong in 1997, China pledged to respect free speech as part of its One Country, Two Systems slogan. However, activists have been increasingly concerned about growing repression in Hong Kong, including the threat seen in the proposed extradition law that would turn over fugitives to mainland Chinese courts. Inside the Legislative Council, young activists trashed the building, sprayed graffiti on symbols of Chinese power, and waved a colonial-era Hong Kong flag. While the brief occupation was condemned by Chinese officials, including Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, Beijing has not yet launched a widespread crackdown on the city's dissidents. Anger among Hong Kong activists exploded after a June 12th confrontation between protesters and police during a mass action in opposition to the proposed extradition law. Police fired tear gas, plastic bullets, and used water hoses against pro-democracy activists. Chinese government officials called the incident a riot, but soon after, the effort to debate and pass the proposed extradition law was indefinitely postponed. The minimum wage in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is stuck at $7.25 an hour, the official federal minimum wage. To make ends meet, many low-income workers must hold down two or three jobs. The city's government is blocked from raising wages by a state preemption law that prohibits municipalities from raising their local minimum wages. Governor John Bel Edwards pledged to raise Louisiana's state minimum wage to $8.50 an hour, but was blocked by the Republican-run legislature. According to the American Prospect, the state's preemption law has a harsh and disproportionate impact on women of color, as Louisiana has the worst gender pay gap in the country. Now a community campaign called Unleash Local is underway to win back local control in Baton Rouge. Before the rise of preemption laws, 40 cities across the U.S. had raised their local minimum wage. But according to the National League of Cities, after the 2010 midterm elections, preemption laws were passed in 26 states, driven by new right-wing legislative majorities and dark money fueled by the Citizens United ruling. These laws have been used primarily by Republican-controlled state legislatures to stop minimum wage hikes, block local anti-discrimination laws, establish sanctuary cities, or offer city employees paid leave benefits. However, Democrats in Colorado recently succeeded in repealing a wage preemption law, with the state's minimum wage now set to rise to $12 an hour in 2020. Louisiana and 10 other states have joined the movement to overturn preemption laws. Sustainable ranching is gaining momentum in the Great Plains states, as ranchers and environmentalists have become allies in prairie restoration. Increasingly, numbers of ranchers are letting their grasslands grow back to pasture. The practice can boost water retention, sequester carbon back into the soil, and can increase profits by producing natural and inexpensive feed, allowing ranchers to brand and sell their beef directly to health-conscious consumers and ecotourists. Still, sustainable practices in the Great Plains, one of the world's largest remaining grasslands extending into western Canada, face long odds. In 2017, more than 2 million acres of grasslands were plowed under for conversion to cropland, but the rate of loss of native grasslands is now decreasing. The Christian Science Monitor reports that preservation of the prairie has brought back wildlife, including pintail ducks and deer. Still, ranchers and environmentalists continue to have major differences over issues such as the environmental impact of raising cattle for meat, leading to soil erosion and significant production of methane, a greenhouse gas. However, long-term plains observers remain optimistic as ranchers and environmentalists focus on common ground rather than decades of differences. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Tens of thousands of asylum seekers being detained by U.S. Customs and Border Protection face overcrowded and filthy conditions in detention centers in places like Clint, Texas. According to lawyers who visited that facility, children as young as 7 and 8 years old, many of them wearing soiled clothing, are caring for infants placed in the same cell. Both adults and children had no access to soap, toothbrushes, and little or no access to adequate food, water, or showers. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, said that she's appalled by the conditions being forced upon migrants after they cross the southern U.S. border, and was deeply shocked that children are forced to sleep on the floor in overcrowded facilities, without access to adequate health care or food, and with poor sanitation conditions. Amid calls by progressive activist groups to close down what they describe as concentration camps, Democrats who control the House of Representatives will soon consider new legislation to address the humanitarian crisis at the southern border. Many legislators were angry that the $4.6 billion emergency spending bill passed on June 25th included no standards for the Trump regime's treatment of migrants at the border. Your reporter spoke with Josh Fox, environmental activist and director, best known for his Oscar-nominated 2010 documentary film Gasland. Here he talks about the humanitarian crisis he observed during a recent visit to Clint, Texas, and the refugee crisis links to climate change.
Like many Americans, I've been completely outraged at what I've seen at the border and what I've heard from reports of families being separated, rampant child abuse, the whole system basically, which is child abuse. And I wanted to go as a person who is a first-generation American. My father was a Holocaust survivor, victim of a survivor of a genocide and the beneficiary of a different type of immigration policy, 60 years ago. If the United States hadn't let my family in when we were facing a genocide, I don't think I would be here talking to you right now. That's definitely for sure. So I felt personally really compelled. And also as a representative of New York City, which is the most diverse city on the planet, I know firsthand how culture in America is born of immigration and benefits from immigration and diversity and a multiplicity of all nations and people. So I felt really compelled, and I was performing last year my solo piece, which is called The Truth Has Changed, which is now a book and will become a film this year, which is about my family's history and about migration and about xenophobia and racism and specifically about the connections between white supremacy and the oil industry. I had performed a piece at a place called Cafe Mayapan in El Paso as we toured it around the country last year. So I had contacts in El Paso who were indigenous activists who were not just fighting the fossil fuel industry, but they were also fighting for justice for migrants. So these dual crises propelled me to go down there this week just to do a preliminary investigation for a documentary, which I will be making over the course of the next year or more. you know, the current crisis is that we have 800,000 immigrants pending cases of asylum at the United States border. That's nearly a million people. What the United Nations is telling us is that it's possible within a decade and a half, that we will have up to 200 million to a billion climate refugees swarming to find new homes on the planet as we approach 2 degrees of warming. That's all across the Earth. But, you know, even at a small percentage, that's upwards of 100 million people trying to come into the United States. That it makes what's happening right now look like a walk in the park. Climate change will bring millions upon millions, hundreds of millions of new migrants all across the world. So we cannot model our policy on xenophobia, racism, detention, concentration camps, and genocide. That is a Mad Max vision of the future unlike any that I can imagine.
You've certainly discussed here tonight the link between the migration crisis in this country and around the world to climate change, and specifically talking about the farmers in Guatemala who can no longer grow crops in many cases and are forced to abandon their land and their ancestral home to come to the United States or somewhere to eke out a living. You also discussed the UN estimates of 200 million to 1 billion climate refugees across the world in the coming years. It leaves one dumbfounded how we as a country or we as a planet can, number one, try to do as much as we can with our very flawed political system that has not moved on addressing climate change in any serious way, and then how we can adjust our societies to address the coming extreme weather, drought, floods, crop failures, and this migration crisis. What kind of optimism do you take away from this?
Well, actually, to be honest, I take quite a bit. There are climate migrants in the United States, climate refugees in the United States. Everybody who lived in Paradise, California, everybody who lived in Mexico Beach, Florida, lots and lots of people who lived in New Orleans who suffered Katrina and then got hit in Houston by Harvey, people in Puerto Rico, people in the United States Virgin Islands. I mean, we're losing an American city per month. We have a climate catastrophe wiping a city off the map worldwide per week. We're going to see a lot more of this to come. This is what I have to say to America. I've traveled this country all over the nation for 10 years, 500 cities. We're getting boring and mean. Our cities are just strip malls at this point across the country. I see nothing but Targets and Walmarts and Applebee's and TGI Fridays and all of this heavily corporatized experience. What makes life beautiful, what makes life great is art and individual initiative and creativity, mom and pop stores, craft beers, amazing chefs, music, all the things that this white monoculture that is sweeping the nation tries to eradicate at every turn. I don't think 200 million new migrants to America is a problem. I think 200 million new migrants to America is a solution. It will make us less boring and mean. It will make us more generous and more beautiful, and it will make us more diverse and extraordinary. How many Trump protesters did I see at the border screaming to keep people out, who then went to a Mexican restaurant for dinner? America is a gorgeous mosaic, as David Dinkins liked to say about New York City. We need to be more gorgeous. We need to be more diverse. We are becoming boring and mean, and we should not be boring and mean. We should be beautiful, accepting, loving, and open.
That was Josh Fox, environmental activist and director, best known for his Oscar-nominated 2010 documentary film, Gasland. His recent live solo performance, The Truth Has Changed, will soon be made into a film. Learn more about the refugee crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border and the links to climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Democratic Party-controlled House of Representatives took its first historic step on April 30th to begin a national debate on the popular proposal to establish a Medicare for All universal health care system in the United States. The hearing before the House Rules Committee that day focused on a bill introduced by Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington, the Medicare for All Act of 2019, that would cover all Americans' health care needs and transition the nation to the program over the course of 2 years. As Medicare for All gains momentum and support from Democratic presidential candidates, the health insurance industry, big pharma, and conservative activist groups have ramped up their lobbying efforts to impede or defeat the measure. Your reporter spoke with Egan Kemp, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizen, who discusses his group's recently published report titled Fever Pitch, Surge in Opposition Lobbying and Advocacy, validates the credibility of the Medicare for All movement, which found that lobbying against proposed Medicare for All legislation has spiked in 2019.
Yes, I think this is a really significant time in our healthcare system, and sort of the path forward, you know, could go in a number of different ways. And these folks want to put their fingers on the scale against the interests of the American people. And just to break down the numbers a little bit, you know, in the first quarter of 2018, we found that only 29 folks were reported lobbying on Medicare for All, either for or against. But by the first quarter of 2019, it was 270, a nearly ninefold increase. And when people, you know, individual lobbyists report that they're lobbying, they report on sort of whose behalf they're lobbying. The number of groups that were working on Medicare for All increased from 9 in the first quarter of 2018 to 61 in the first quarter of 2019, a nearly sevenfold increase. And one of the things that, you know, we thought was most important to really get out there was that 9 of the 10 entities, the ones that hired the most, 9 of the 10 of them were against Medicare for All. And those groups accounted for more than half of all lobbyists working on the issue, really highlighting that the tide has turned. They're taking this seriously. And I think that's the important piece of this context. These groups are seeing Americans need Medicare for All, demand Medicare for All, pressure their Congress members, pressure 2020 candidates. And they know that they've got to start pushing back if they're going to keep their profits, because that's what they're worried about.
Now, what about the role of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Koch brothers that is mentioned in the report, or any other organizations or new coalitions that have come together to fight Medicare for All? Maybe you could tell us a bit about these groups.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting who's who of who makes money off of our current system or who doesn't want to pay more in taxes. I mean, two new coalitions have been minted just in the last 6 months or so. The Coalition Against Socialized Medicine, which is a lot of Koch-funded groups like FreedomWorks, also ones they funded like Heritage Action and the Club for Growth, as well as ones with close ties like the American Conservative Union. Then the other really big one is the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which has an innocuous sounding name, but really should be called Partnership for Profiting Off America's Healthcare. It includes biotech industry, it includes big pharma, it includes for-profit insurers. And they really don't want to have this discussion go any further. And that's why they're really starting to put money in. And then you're also seeing, you know, as you mentioned, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I mean, the CEO recently said they'd be willing to use all of their resources to lobby against single-payer health care. And finally, One Nation, which, you know, sounds pretty innocuous, but it's founded by Karl Rove, and they did all sorts of lobbying around when the Republicans were trying to repeal the ACA and take away Americans' health care. Now they're taking that new money, taking money now and putting it against single-payer health care so that Americans can't get the health care that they need after losing the fight to take away Americans' health care.
What do we know about public opinion now? Where do Americans stand in general on the proposed Medicare for All plans that are out there in House and Senate?
Yes, no, it's an exciting time, and we're really seeing sort of the grassroots pressure growing for Medicare for All, and the polling consistently going in our favor with majorities, and sometimes, you know, as high as 70% of Americans, depending on the poll, expressing support for Medicare for All. And one of the things that, you know, critics often say is, oh, well, they don't know what's in it. But recent polling from Politico found that Americans do understand it better than you'd expect, and that, you know, if they can keep their doctors and their hospitals, which they would be able to do under Medicare for All, the support is really there. And it's one of those things that, you know, Americans, there's a perception that as Americans understand that, you know, their healthcare system would change, that they would be afraid of it. But really, as Americans are hearing more about it, and I think a big part of this is the discussion in Congress, the discussion in the presidential debate, they're really understanding that Medicare for All is something that's achievable. You know, there's over 60 countries that have some sort of universal healthcare system. They're starting to understand that it would cost less. I mean, you just look at how much less the Medicare system costs while providing care to folks with, you know, increasing medical needs. And just how many challenges they face right now, whether it's surprise bills, whether it's deductibles as, you know, as high as $5,000. no family can get the care they need like that. And Medicare for All addresses all of those issues at once, which is a real opportunity for improvement in our healthcare system.
Egan, as we conclude, what should our listeners keep in mind about the fight ahead for those who favor Medicare for All and establishing a single-payer system like that in the country? What are some of the effective things they can do right now to both educate themselves on this topic and also to get in there to help advocate for it?
When we look across the country, there's lots of groups working at the state and local level to put pressure on members of Congress, whether they're federal officials, whether they're state officials, to be making progress on healthcare and Medicare for All specifically. Also, there's a lot of work going on resolution campaigns. If you go to our website, www.citizen.org, there's all sorts of great information about our resolutions campaign and all the groups that we're working with. And I can't emphasize it enough. It sounds simple, but vote. And people will see that, you know, the American people are supporting a change to a healthcare system that would benefit them and would finally mean the American people would have a right to healthcare as opposed to just being able to get the healthcare they can afford.
That was Egan Kemp, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizen. Find a link to Public Citizen's report titled Fever Pitch, Surge in Opposition Lobbying and Advocacy Validates the Credibility of the Medicare for All Movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In June, the Federal Bureau of Prisons announced that it was canceling the construction of a maximum security prison that it had been planning to build on top of a former mountaintop removal coal mine site in Letcher County in eastern Kentucky. A coalition of environmental, criminal justice reform, and local community members had fought the $510 million project for almost 4 years. The coalition of groups included Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, the Center for Biological Diversity, and the Kentucky Student Environmental Coalition. Opponents argued that the prison wasn't needed and that the location was dangerous for both prisoners and prison workers. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Panayoti Cholkis, co-founder of the Prison Ecology Project, part of the Human Rights Defense Center. Here he talks about how the coalition came together and defeated the well-financed prison project.
It was a federal maximum security prison on a little over 700 acres of former mountaintop removal strip mine site. And it was on one side, it was kind of surrounded. One side, it was near a coal sludge pond. So like the waste from coal mining dumped in a giant pit, basically toxic waste storage. You know, this is very much like kind of a heart of coal country. We were looking at how prisons and the environment had intersections. And the environmental impact statement for the Letcher County prison proposal came up for public comment. And so in 2015, you know, I proposed that we look at the environmental impact statement and plan a campaign around it. You know, my experience is primarily in the environmental movement, doing grassroots organizing, direct action, what we call paper wrenching, basically, you know, engaging in the administrative legal process as citizen petitioners. I reached out to some of the organizations on the ground in Kentucky and some of the national groups I was part of, and some lawyers I had worked with, and proposed this idea of taking this on as a national campaign and coordinating with local people on the ground. And you know, to our surprise, we got a lot of support and interest last fall. The Record of Decision was released after about 3.5 years of being delayed by our opposition, by our public comments and you know, our coordination with local landowners on the ground. We had held the prison off, but they finally issued a Record of Decision in 2018. And in November of last year, we filed a lawsuit coordinating with 21 federal prisoners around the country who had a variety of issues with the prison, namely that they were not informed about the public comment process, and when they attempted to get information, you know, it was not made available in a timely fashion, so they weren't able to, you know, file comments. in particular, their comments were related to, you know, health concerns, public health concerns, and the impacts of prisoners' health on, you know, on top of this former industrial mining site. So those prisoners, in conjunction with the Abolitionist Law Center, which is a nonprofit based in Western Pennsylvania, they filed a lawsuit.
Panayoki Cholkas, what were some of the arguments your coalition made to stop the prison?
We felt that some of the issues that were presented were pretty irrefutable, namely that the federal prison population was actually declining, that the numbers they used saying this prison was necessary, they reflected numbers from 10 years ago, not today. We saw that, you know, our impact from the lawsuit was a huge part of the Bureau of Prisons' decision to rescind the plan. Basically, they said that they didn't need or want this prison any longer. They cited the prison population numbers that we had brought up. They cited potential environmental concerns that we had raised about 6 weeks ago. They started saying that they didn't plan to move forward with the prison, and then it became official around a month ago, mid-June. So we started celebrating that major victory. I think the first federal prison that we could find that had been stopped with that sort of environmental pressure. It also was the most expensive federal prison on record in the history of prison construction, $510 million, so over $500 million.
Do you see the possibility of this coalition working together in the future?
You know, we want to build off this victory and off the alliance between prison abolitionists and environmental activists that formed to fight this Letcher County prison. And I think it's a model that could be replicated and built around. Like, for example, right now in Alabama, there's a proposal to build new prisons that will have to undergo an environmental review. Those are state-level prisons, so it'll be a little bit different. But a lot of the strategies that were explored and kind of honed in the Letcher County fight, it could be applicable on both state and county levels, where I think people could form similar alliances and really push back hard against the effort to expand prison and jail system in this country.
That was Panayoti Cholkas with the Prison Ecology Project. Learn more about how a broad coalition of groups defeated the plan to build an environmentally compromised federal prison in Kentucky by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRGU in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, KDNK in Carbondale, Colorado, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.